preaching of God's word than is in Luke's Gospel, chapter 12, and there at verses 4 and 5. The context is set before us in verse 1, that he is speaking unto his disciples. He's warned against hypocrisy. And now notice these two verses as Christ speaks to his own. And I say unto you, my friends, be not afraid of them that kill the body, and after that have no more that they can do. But I will forewarn you whom ye shall fear. Fear him which after he hath killed hath power to cast into hell. Yea, I say unto you, fear him. It is a rewarding and edifying, though searching, exercise to read the lives of those who faced and endured the fires of persecution. We have, of course, names that immediately conjure up in our mind's eye such seasons of the church's experience. And so you think of Queen Mary, colloquially known as Bloody Mary, and the putting to death of faithful Christians. One such, of course, as he is known as Bishop Hooper. Hooper was called to recant, and think of this for a moment. He was called to recant in these ways, that he would turn from the purity of the Reformed faith, and that he would acknowledge the propriety of Roman Catholicism. And he is called to do so, having been in prison and now tied to a stake. And he is reminded, not only by words, but by his own present experience, that there is pain to come if he does not recant. And bound to the stake, as is reported, he says the following: life is sweet, death is bitter, but eternal life is more sweet, and eternal death more bitter. And so the stake was set to flames, and he perished in an agonizing death. Brethren, I imagine that you and I would consent to what Hooper stated. And yet, it's not likely, though God certainly may order it otherwise, that you and I should be tied to a stake and asked to recant the true and scriptural faith. But it's important for us to see that this is an extreme. Persecution is an extreme temptation. Every temptation has the same essence. It is calling you and me in one way or another, to one degree or another, to recant the faith. Now, it doesn't come in such bolden and in such brazen words as were presented to Hooper and his fellow martyrs, and not only in the 16th century, but certainly even in the earliest days of the church, but also in the history of Israel, the covenant people of God facing these things. The essence of temptation comes to us and says, will you live by faith and walk in holiness, or will you seek comfort in this life because of what is potentially offered to you? So it's important for us to understand that as we think perhaps, as in our mind, we put ourselves in such circumstances and say, what would I do? What would I do if a knife came to my throat and said, if you don't deny Christ, it's over? What would I do if a gun were placed to my child's head and said, if you don't recant Christ, your child is dead? What would I do in such circumstances at such times? And we, in the comfort and ease of our present lives, say, I would stand bold. Yes, by God's grace, and so on. It's important for us actually to make a further connection. What will I do when Christ's word says this, and yet someone whom I love or respect disagrees? Will I be faithful to Christ's word? Will I endure scoffings? Will I endure mockery, ridicule? Will I, as a student, be willing to endure the jokes of fellow students? Will I, as a worker, be willing to endure the ridicule of co-workers? Will I be willing, if it is necessary, to lose my job? Will I be willing to endure the difficulties within family if I am faithful to the cause of Christ? You see, it doesn't require a flame. It doesn't require a blade. It doesn't require a gun, actually, to present this to us. What it requires is this. Will I honor God, or will I capitulate to honor man? Now notice, the context is to his disciples, and this is important for a few reasons, not only as it is in the scriptures themselves, but because notice Christ's statement when he says to his friends, to his disciples, verse 5, fear him, which hath, after he hath killed, hath power to cast into hell. Yea, I say unto you, fear him. Instead of living, as it were, in the light of what men might do to me, I am to live in light of what God could do to me. Now, some would say this is Satan, but let's remember, who has the power of life? Who has the keys of life, of death, of hell? It's not Satan, it's God. Satan throws none into hell. And this is clearly pictured for us when it is that God, at the final judgment, gathers up the wicked and casts them into hell. It's not Satan gathering them up. It's not Satan whom we're to fear. It's not the superstition of goblins and ghouls and demons that we're to walk around cowering before. But rather, we are to have a consciousness that there is a holy God in heaven who sees, who acknowledges, who notes all things. And for those who deny him, even in extreme seasons of persecution, as Christ says, who denies me before men, will I deny before my Father and the angels. And so, notice the text, it's addressed to Christ's loved ones. You notice verse 1, he says to his disciples, but you also notice in our text, in verse 4, I say unto you, my friends, those who are dear to me, those who are beloved of me, I'm warning you. I'm giving this address to you. So in other words, though there are elements of the passage which need to be broadcast to the world, surely the world needs to be brought into understanding that there is a God who will judge. But Christ is putting it in the context of his disciples and saying, we have need to remember. When Paul writes to the Corinthians, he acknowledges that one motive is remembering the terror of the Lord. So he proclaims the gospel and warnings to God's people. This isn't the only motive. It's not an isolated, as it were, motive. But it is surely to be something that reminds us of the importance of the things before us. Now notice the correction he gives in the text. He says, be not afraid. And the way it's expressed is he's saying, have no fear. It was popular 10, 15, 20 years ago to see stickers on the backs of cars and trucks that said, no fear. T-shirts, no fear, and all these things. And you see them every once in a while. And men love to go about boasting of how fearless they are. And yet the most emboldened of men, when they gain a glimpse of God, will be terror-struck at his sight. Well, it's unfortunate that even the most emboldened of men, when a sword is put to their throat, when a fire is warned and threatened upon them, that then they fear man. That was the temptation of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Fear Nebuchadnezzar. And notice, as we pointed out, they said, we're not anxious to answer you about this. We don't have fear. And that's what Christ is getting at here. Have no fear. About what? Of them which can kill the body. Now, you and I know that there are deaths which are, as we say, painless, and there are deaths which are full of torture. And yet it's important for us to see that Christ makes no distinction. If they have the power of putting you to death, you're not to fear them. Why? Not because there's not real pain, perhaps, but because, as he says, their ability to inflict terror and pain is limited to this life. As he notes, After that, they have no more that they can do. The worst they can do is take away your belongings. They can take away your comforts. They can take away your peace. They can take away your life. But after that, their ability is completed. And then notice he moves to an exhortation. Fear him. So instead of fearing not, this is not the scene. This is not the context. This is not the stage of fear. Here's where you need to direct your gaze. Fear him, whom after he hath killed, hath power to cast into hell. We noted already, this is not man. It's not even Satan. It's God. And so Christ takes our eyes from all of the clanging of swords and the military posturing of threats and of stakes with fire and guillotines and prisons that are dank and filthy and the privation of comfort. And he says, none of that's worthy of your fear. But that doesn't mean there's not one who is. You're to look to God and see he has power not only to take my life, but to cast me into hell. This would have no pain, as it were, upon us, were there not something in us that made us worthy of hell, that we've sinned. Now, what we wish to note is that Christ is addressing a very common fear. There is, of course, before us the distinction between body and soul. Man is comprised of both body and soul together. But so often in this life, though men, even godless men, will acknowledge the reality of a soul, so much of this life is fixated upon the body. Our discomforts, our comforts, our life, our illness. That's what the concern of the world is. Whatever the right motives, you can see this even in the present day, where all of this attention is given to the outward care of the body. Now, it's not that the body is not worthy of our attention, but when the body is, as it were, the center of our attention, we actually lose sight of that importance placed upon the soul. This isn't to neglect the body, but it is rather to put before us the importance of that which is often unseen, surely always unseen to our eyes, but often unnoticed by our minds. And likewise to remember that whereas, as Hooper said, death is bitter, eternal death is more bitter. And so before us, we wish to address the sphere of man, which consists in all of the different ways that they can take away comfort and inflict pain. And it's important for us to remember, though the extreme is here dealt with, death, yet there are lesser degrees of the sphere. Popularity, inclusion with others, jobs, comforts, all of these things are bound up in it. So consider then three things that by the Lord's blessing may help us to turn our attention away from the fear of man, that we might rightly give glory unto him who alone is worthy of our honor. Consider firstly the experience of this godless fear, the error of this godless fear, and the conquering of this godless fear. First, the experience consists, at least in summary, three things. It has a sight, it has a thought, and it has an action. The sight of this godless fear is ever fixed upon man. But not just man in general, twofold ways is it fixed. It's fixed upon what we have and what we want as man. And it's also fixed upon what other men can do to us or against us. That's the sight of this fear. It zeroes in on it. Now, if you've ever been target shooting, you realize the importance of true sights, having a rifle, as it were, sighted in accurately. And when it is that you are shooting at targets, the attention almost of your entire body is consumed upon that target. There are other things, of course, to be factored in, but you aren't shooting at a target to lift your eyes to something else and then pull the trigger. all of your attention, even the moderation of your breathing is such that will allow you to hit the target that your sights are upon. Now, this is the problem. The experience of this fear is that the sight is controlling. It's, as it were, blocking out everything else. There are times in our experience when we're so zeroed in on something that everything else in the room vanishes. It's gone. We're focusing, looking, staring, that we don't notice anything else. We're so fixed upon it. And that's what goes on with the fear of man. The sights are set both upon our comfort, our continuation, and what man may do against us. That it has actually a blinding effect. It blinds everything else out. And so this is one thing that Christ is warning us against. That we be sure that our sight is not fixed upon the strength and power of men against us. And what's interesting is, in times of persecution, what is it that's calling for our attention? Well, you saw it in Nebuchadnezzar, right? I'm Nebuchadnezzar. I have power to put you to death. I can do this to you, right? It's shouting out. It's calling for your sights to be fixed upon it. And you can go to lesser experiences. What is it when in a circle of fellow students or fellow workmen and so on, there's this temptation, as it were, to go along with them in sin, to join in with their sin? It's, look what we're doing, and if you want to be part of us, you better go and do as we do. You better compromise your principles so that you can remain with us. If you don't, you'll be put away. A job comes and asks us to do something sinful. And what's being said? Look at what I offer you. I offer you greater pay, greater benefits, greater whatever else you want. And if you don't do as I'm saying, all of these things are lost. And of course, if they're lost, you have no pay, you have no earthly provision, all these things are taken away. That's what temptation is doing. It's calling for the sight to be fixed upon earthly concerns. That's one way of assessing ourselves. Where is my sight in times of temptation? Where is my attention? What am I looking at? Because when you're looking at something, you necessarily are not looking at other things. You say, well, that's quite insightful. Spiritually, it is a key which will unlock godliness. When you look upon men as your object of fear, adoration, concern, comfort, blessing, whatever else, you necessarily have stopped looking at God. And this is fundamental. But the experience of this fear not only has sight, it has thought. It thinks. Because as it's fixed upon man, what is it doing? It's thinking to itself, look what this man, look what this woman, look what this group of men and women have power to do or to keep from me. They have power to keep from me life in the most extreme forms. They can, as Christ say, kill the body. They can do lesser things. They can imprison. They can give fines. They can take away certain things. All of these things start running through our minds. And what happens is like water going down a hole. It creates this vortex that sucks all of our attention down with it. It spins quicker and quicker, it seems, and it sucks and takes all of our affections with it. Because this whirlwind that starts going through our minds is, as it were, shaking our attention from God and making our affections, which are to be set above where Christ is seated, to grip and lay hold of the things of this world. We don't want the pain of family discord. We don't want the difficulty of losing a job. We don't want the shame, the embarrassment of losing friends and the pleasure of comforts that they provide us. This is a thought that follows the sight when we fear man. But lastly, it also has an action. If unchecked by the grace of God, it will lead to one of two things, both of which are sinful. It will lead either to a compromising, or as sometimes said, a rounding of the corners. Well, I'll hold to the principle in general, but not firmly enough that it might provoke others against me. So I'll say it in measured ways so that in the end, I preserve the comfort of this relationship. I preserve the comfort of my job. I preserve the comfort of my life, and so on. But be sure that the compromising of a principle is disloyalty to God. It's rebellion. Christ doesn't say, listen, follow me apart from when it's really difficult and you might lose something. That's the significance of him saying, if you're going to be my disciple, what does he start with? He starts with this, deny yourself. And then he follows with, take up your cross daily. And then he goes to, follow me. You see, there can be no true discipleship because he says, if you would be my disciple, if you would be my follower, this is the order. It starts with an outright denial of self. You've lost your claim upon yourself. This is why the Christian, in one sense, loses the right to say, well, I think differently. I think. It doesn't matter what we think. What matters is what Christ, by his word, has told us. Because so soon as his claim is contradicted by our thoughts, we're no longer functioning as a disciple. So the compromise, though it may give some remnant of appearance of loyalty, is yet in the end a sinful thing. But the other thing it often leads to, if unchecked by God's grace, is entirely to capitulate and to join in with the sin outrightly. Think of it this way. You have three in Daniel 3, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But it's not just Israel who was conquered by Babylon. It's not just Nebuchadnezzar has overtaken Israel. He's overtaken a bunch of kingdoms. And they all have their other gods and so on that are to whom they're to be loyal. But when he gives this command, it says, all the nations, all languages, all people bowed. What did they do? They put two and two together. Here's what the greatest, the mighty one says we're to do. If we don't do it, we're dead. So let's put away our principle, apart from the principle that says self-preservation is number one. And so let's bow down. Unfortunately, that isn't only found in pagan religions. It's found as well among those who in various ways profess the true religion. And though indeed even Peter, that great apostle, did in his own experience deny Christ outrightly, and yet was renewed as God will restore his chosen ones, yet there are many who prove themselves not to be God's chosen people by their outright rejection. And this, of course, is to enter into what Christ said, him that denies me before men will I deny before the angels of my Father. So here, the sight, the thought, and the action of the godless fear of man. Secondly, the error of this godless fear. And again, three things that the error consists of. It consists of a mistake, of an exaggeration, and of an ignoring. The mistake is this, that it mistakes the purpose that we are given. The purpose is fed to us today in tremendous and at times overpowering ways. And it comes to us in our culture like this. You can be whatever you want. Live your life. Be happy. All of which, of course, sounds decent, but it sounds decent because it's flattering. And if we struggle with anything, it's with our outrageous and imbalanced love of self. So when people come and say to us, seek out what makes you happy, we say, oh, that sounds pretty good. I should seek out what makes me happy. You can be whatever you want to be. You say, yeah, I can be whatever I want to be. You're the captain of your ship. You can direct it wherever you want. Now, the difficulty is there's a semblance of truth in it, at least in our lives in this nation. That there are many things in a life of great comfort and ease that we have time to give ourselves to. That message doesn't translate in other cultures. It actually doesn't work. Go into the tribes of Africa and say something like this: do whatever makes you happy. And they would look at you astounded, like, that's impossible. My life can't be lived that way. Go into Mexico and say, be whatever you want to be. And they'll look at you and say, again, impossible, I can't do that. Life doesn't work that way. That message is only for a people of great comfort and ease. The whole idea of the so-called pre-tribulation rapture doesn't make sense to 99.9% of the church. That God would remove his people from outward grief and difficulty, the message is actually flying in the face of both scripture and experience. But here's the problem: that all men are tempted to think through in those days of temptation. It's to think that my first calling is to preserve my life, my well-being, my family, my family's well-being. Instead of remembering that our primary, our all-encompassing, our comprehensive calling at all times is to honor God. The fundamental mistake of this error when we fear men is that we put ourselves as primary and everything else, including God, as secondary. Now, this doesn't mean that we ought not to be prudent in our wise and godly preserving of our lives. God has made the body. And so there are occasions, as Christ says, listen, if they're going to come and persecute the city, flee. He doesn't forbid that. Of course, we're to eat daily our food and provide for our bodies. But the difficulty is this: when the temptation comes, whether it's outrightly persecuting or in lesser degrees temptation, it comes and it says, which is first? Is God first or are you? What persecution does is it puts it in the most tangible expression possible. If you put God first, you're dead. If you put yourself first, you live. Now, what does that demand? It demands, if you're to live, put yourself first and sin against God. Now, you can translate that to all other scenarios of temptation. Are you going to put God first and deny what friends or co-workers or the world is saying? Well, if you're going to do that, you're going to experience some degree of difficulty. Or are you going to put yourself first and seek comfort and advancement and other such things? Well, then, you're going to have to say no to God. And so it makes a mistake in forgetting our main purpose. Is it no wonder that the outbreak and the flood of iniquity of our day was preceded by a strategic and a deliberate and a systemic effort to teach children in schools, do what makes you happy, believe in yourself, go about and do what you want? It's not a coincidence. That message is the soil that brings forth all of these things, because the message appears respectful. It appears, as it were, helpful. But what it denies is what it denies and what it doesn't say. It doesn't say under God. It doesn't say fear God. Do you remember last week we read from Ecclesiastes? It says, here's the whole sum of the matter. And what does it say? Fear God. That's the sum. And so when that's the governing principle, everything else can fall into place. As so long as I'm fearing God, yes, I then can do what might bring pleasure and comfort, because it won't be a godless pleasure and comfort, and I'll be willing to part with those pleasures and comforts if ever it comes into conflict with fearing God. So the call of the Christian is not one to some morbid and burdensome and painstaking life of grueling hardship. There are those as solid, as gracious, as godly Christians who have had many comforts. But so soon as temptation comes, their godliness will show itself in this: They have no fear about what they could lose. They have no fear of what you might take from them. They don't care if you bring that so long as you, as they hold fast to God. This is why Paul says, listen, I've learned to live in much or in want. If I have a full pantry, I know how to live in such a way that honors God. If I have no food and no certainty from where I'm going to get my next meal, I have no fear because I know that God will provide as He's promised. And so it puts the fear puts ourselves as our primary instead of remembering God as primary. Now this needs to be dealt with in far more ways than we can, but think of this for a moment. You think of the prophets and how many of them were told from the commission of their call, you will suffer. You will have zero success with this people. They will torment, they will ridicule, they will mock, they will imprison you, you will do all these things, and they won't care, but go and preach my word. That's their commission. And yet, though they struggled in various ways, as we are a mixed people, as it were, even in ourselves, the principle of God's grace is at work while the remaining sin is there wrestling still, yet they receive that by God's grace, and they counted not their lives as something to be grabbed hold of, but they gave themselves to God. You heard, as McShane recorded in the 1800s, of that mission work that was desired for a colony of lepers, which to enter meant you would never return, and which at that day meant certain death, and how there were not only men ready to go and live and preach the gospel among them, but there were men behind them saying, when they've died, we're up, we're going. You've heard of various missionaries from Wittenberg and Luther's day, Geneva and Calvin's day, and all throughout these cities and centers of the Reformation, that around them was the flame of persecution, which to be caught meant certain excruciating death, and they said, send me. And you've heard even in recent days of a man who is willing to go into the land of certain death if he's found out as a Christian. For what purpose? To preach the gospel. And he says, so may it be that I might serve God. One thing these men have in common is that they know what their life is for. Question is, do you? Do you know what your life is for? It's not for you. It's for God. But the other mistake that this error makes is that it exaggerates. And what it exaggerates is the importance of men and his ability to take from us what we have. It doesn't mistake so much as exaggerates this point. Because notice what Christ says. He says that they are able to kill the body. And that's what is zeroed in, right? We fear that. They're able to take something from us. But the exaggeration comes in this, that that's the main thing. It makes the exaggeration that if we take this from you, we've taken everything from you. But the Christian knows better. The Christian knows, yes, the body's important. It has dignity. It's to be honored and cared for. And we're not just to care for our own, but others' bodies as the Lord gives us opportunity and so on. But in the grand scheme of things, we realize that man is more than his or her body. That there is a soul which cannot be, as it were, put out, but will be before God in judgment. And so why was it that Hooper said that he would not recant? Because he knew there was a greater judge. He knew there was one who was superior to those who could light the flame that would take his body, that there was one who has already lit the flame that will consume the souls of those without Christ. And the third fear of this, or the third error of this fear, is that it ignores. It ignores both the soul and God. It says, focus on your body, focus on this world. And it removes from us the remembering of our soul and the remembering of God. Well, lastly, then, the conquering of this fear, which should be in many ways apparent in some degree. But two things that if we're to conquer this fear, we're to remember. The first is this, we're to remember what we are. And we could get very deep in this, but in simple terms, remember this, two things. You are both body and soul. And secondly, you are an image bearer of God, which necessarily means that you exist not for yourself, but for Him who has made you. What am I? We should ask, not in some ridiculous, speculative, philosophically unbound way, but to be directed again to the Scriptures. What do the Scriptures say I am? This is what the Scriptures say I am. I'm a creature. I am a dependent and contingent being. I am body and soul, which means we are to care for the body, but never in some outlandish way that neglects our soul, and more importantly, our God, who has made both body and soul. Remember what you are. And Christian, remember this. You have been bought with a price. And what does Paul say following? Therefore, glorify God in your body and in your souls, which are God's. Remember what you are. If you remember what you are, not just at the flame of persecution, but in the sparks and the difficulties of lesser forms of temptation, you'll look at them and say, if I weren't God's creature, if I weren't both body and soul, if I weren't redeemed by Christ, I'd go and follow that. But since I am a creature, since I am both body and soul, and since I am redeemed by the blood of Christ, this is nothing to me. But the second thing we're to remember is in the forefront of Christ's teaching. We're to remember God's supremacy and to acknowledge Him in all our pursuits. Persecution in all of its forms, temptation in all of their forms, tell us, as it were, in whispered tones or in the shouts of deafening volume, don't concern yourself with God. And it may do so directly, as Nebuchadnezzar, who is that God who can deliver you out of the fiery furnace? But it often does so far more subtly and fixes your sight upon itself. But if it is that we remember God's supremacy, that He is the one who is able, as Christ says, to kill the body and after to cast into hell, that will make us say, why would I consider that to my own judgment? But there's something implicit in this as well. Man says, I have the way of life for you. But we as Christians remember God has the way of eternal life for us. And so we remember God's supremacy, not only in what pains He can bring, but in what blessings and enjoyments He can bring. So as we close, consider just this as the word of exhortation. Though there are some who would say to you today, it's most certain the next 5 to 10 years persecution will come to America and so on, who can say that with utter certainty? We do say whether persecution or whether days of tremendous comfort and ease, your need and my need is to be in a land of plenty and a land of comfort, to be purposed and deliberate in cultivating the fear of God. Because everything in the air we breathe is telling us to do other than that. Everything in the air we breathe says, choose what you want. You walk into a grocery store, you're faced with this, even in an implicit way. We don't say it's bad, but we're just pointing out how it's presenting itself. It's saying, do you want this cereal or that cereal? Or the whole aisle of cereals, which one do you want? Which one do you prefer? Which one do you desire? And do you want it in this size or that size? Do you want this many boxes or this many boxes? You go to the aisle for meat, and what do you see? Do you want this type of meat? Do you want that type of meat? In this type of meat, how many pieces do you want? What cut of it do you want? All of these things come to us. And again, we're thankful for that. We don't say that's sinful. We receive it with thanksgiving. But we need to be mindful when we have in those things such a mass of choices that subtly cultivate in us. I'm the one who decides. We then, in a land of plenty, must be all the more diligent to cultivate the fear of God. And so it's not saying all these things are wrong. It's saying rather, because of tendencies of sin in us, when these things are in place, there's a temptation to cultivate the cherishing of self. So you hear this in advertisements. If you turn the radio on, what do you hear? All of these glowing reviews of what will bring you happiness. The implicit message in that is that that's what matters. The implicit attachment in that is they're thinking, here's how I connect with the audience. I need to make sure that they realize my product will give them personal pleasure. They'll gain further comforts. They'll gain greater influence. They'll gain greater health. And all of that is teaching us to think first about ourselves. That's why we have to be all the more deliberate in carving out time to cultivate the fear of God. How many times have we said to ourselves, we listen to a sermon in person, we listen to it online perhaps, we read a book that's helpful and godly, we read the Bible, of course, which is supreme above all, and we say, that's worth thinking about. We close it up and we run the race of the day. And we don't sit down and reflect and meditate. We don't sit down and carve out an hour for personal and deliberate meditation, confession of sin, laying hold of the promises, resolving and covenanting with God to walk in His way. We say that's something that needs to be dealt with, and we push it down the line. It satisfies our conscience for a moment because we've acknowledged it's something that needs to be dealt with. It gets it out of our mind and throws it into the abyss of things that we've said needs to be dealt with and never will be. Brethren, if you find yourself gripped by anxiety and the fear of man, that is a siren and an alarm going off to say this. You have need to carve out time now to cultivate the fear of God. If you've capitulated or compromised your witness for Christ because of what you thought you gained with men or what you kept, you have need to cultivate repentance in the fear of God. This demands deliberate meditation upon God. What is God? Why is this God worthy of my unqualified submission? You realize there's nothing in this world that is worthy of that. Nothing in this world can come to you and say unqualified submission to me. But God not only can, but does. Why? Well, some in their sin say it's because he's a tyrant and all these things. But you see, what they've revealed is they haven't thought about God. God is worthy of our instant, wholesale, unqualified submission for many reasons. And we think, how can I meditate? You know, that's going to take time and I don't know how to do it. Well, here's something to start with. Why is God worthy of it? And get a sheet of paper out and start writing. And if you say, I can't think of it, start reading the Bible. Start praying over it. In your home, start thinking about it. And ask yourself, why is God worthy of it? And here are just some starters. Not only is God sovereign, but He's good. Always. Not only is God all-knowing, He's wise. Not only is God sovereign, but He's pure. He's eternal. And you go through His attributes and you start to think. You say, well, that's a lot of things, and I think I know what they mean, but what do they mean? And you start collating and collecting texts, and you read through and pray through them. And you start getting books and reading through those, and you start talking with others, and you start thinking about God. It's meditating upon Him. And what does this mean then for my life? What does this mean for all the world? And likewise, as we cultivate fear, we meditate, but we also pray, praying for help, praying for the Lord's grace, because we realize that ever contending within ourselves is, as Calvin says, the manufacturing of idols. And so what is sufficient to overcome that infatuation with our petty desires? It's that God comes in the power of His grace, that He would plant His image in beauty and glory. Two things to remember as you cultivate this fear is to remember life's brevity, as Christ indicates, and eternity's duration. Life is sweet, death is bitter, but eternal life more sweet, and eternal death more bitter. Would you stand with me for prayer?